Welcome to the Natural Healing Show. Keep it natural. Be the Natural Healing Show.
Hello, you are listening to the Natural Healing Show for UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Kurikan, medical intuitive healer, Amazon number one bestselling author. You can find out more about me and my work at CatherineKurikan.com and UnlimitedEnergyNow.com. While you're there, definitely sign up for my newsletter so you can learn even more about how you can heal yourself naturally. Now, our guest today is Dr. John Abramson, medical doctor. Dr. John Abramson is the author of Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. And Dr. John Abramson does not have a website, so to learn more about him and his wonderful work, you have to read his books, which are available on Amazon. Welcome, Dr. John Abramson.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So, Dr. John Abramson, will you share for our audience some of the names of your other books? Because I know Sickening is only one of your many books.
Right. Well, two books. The first book was called Overdosed America, and it was published in 2004.
Okay. All right. So Overdosed America and Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. So Dr. John Abramson, medical doctor, can you explain for our audience about your background and expertise so they understand where you're coming from?
Sure. And the part of my career that we're going to be talking about now was completely unplanned. And I will tell you how that happened. I went to medical school. In fact, I graduated from Brown Medical School, where you went to school. I did an internship in family medicine and then went into the public health service for a couple of years and went to Case Western to finish my residency. After my residency at Case Western, I spent 2 years doing a research fellowship, a Robert Wood Johnson Research Fellowship, the goal of which was to train family physicians to be able to be treated as peers in the academic world and do research and teaching and so forth. I had a change of heart and decided that my real calling was to go be a real doctor in the community and set up a practice in a small town about an hour north of Boston, a family practice. And I made house calls and took care of dying people and saw newborn babies in the hospital. And it was really a wonderful practice. And I, during those years, I was a conventional doctor, but I cared deeply about my patients and I taught Harvard medical students in my office. And one of those students was very committed to a spiritual practice. And she organized an elective at Harvard Medical School called Healing and Spirituality and asked me to teach in that because it wasn't something that I had thought was an explicit part of my practice. But she felt that the way I related to patients involved a connection at a deep level that is referred to sometimes as spiritual. It looked like a regular doctor-patient relationship. And I started teaching in that course. And then as time went on, I became a course director of this elective at Harvard Medical School called Healing and Spirituality. And it was really important stuff. It was kind of to help medical students not become the kind of automatons that doctors can become when they're trying to learn all that information and are playing defense because they don't want to miss anything. But rather, my goal was to teach medical students that it's not only good medicine, but it's necessary medicine to have a deep relationship with your patients. And I was going to write a book about that. That was late 90s and early 2000s. I was going to write a book about that, and my career would have gone off in that direction, but for the debacle that was Vioxx, an arthritis medicine made by Merck. And this was a drug that was marketed. Its only advantage was that it was, supposed advantage was that it was gentler on the stomach, but and it was slightly gentler on the stomach, but it more than doubled the risk of heart attacks, blood clots, and strokes. And this information had been covered up. And when I started to get the drift of what was going with this, and that the New England Journal was broadcasting the misinformation that Merck had submitted to them in an article, and the FDA knew about it and wasn't picking up on it, I realized that I couldn't devote myself to that other book about healing and spirituality when what turned out to be about 50,000 people, Americans, were dying because this drug was on the market and the New England Journal continued to cover it up and the FDA continued to cover it up. So I dropped that book, much to my editor's chagrin, and I remember how upset she was, clearly, and dropped that book and started to write a book about how the journals were being taken over by the drug companies. And the drug company's primary mission was to make as much money as they could. And if people's health got harmed along the way, that was being treated just as collateral damage to their fundamental mission of maximizing their profits. So I left practice and wrote Overdosed America, which came out in September 2004. And Vioxx was pulled a week after my book came out. And that was not like the current times now. That was when the news actually covered stories where pharma was being criticized, deservedly being criticized. That doesn't happen anymore, and people like me aren't on TV anymore. But when Vioxx got pulled off the market, I was on the Today Show and did about 100 national TV shows and was kind of a go-to guy when something happened in the drug industry. And in the process of being on TV, getting all that exposure, lawyers saw me, the lawyers who sue the drug companies in the national litigation. So when there's a big case like Vioxx, where there were 27,000 plaintiffs, lawyers form up into a national team and they hire one set of experts so that they don't have to hire experts for each person who's suing. They hire one set of experts who then represent all the 27,000 plaintiffs. And the expertise that I had originally gotten from Robert Wood Johnson during my fellowship and then writing the book Overdosed America, it taught me how to present science in a way that the public could understand. The lawyers saw that. They asked me to participate in this national litigation. And that started a second career of being an expert in litigation. Now, in that, When you're an expert in litigation, you have to sign a confidentiality agreement. And then we would literally get the hard drives from the drug companies. Nothing was hidden. All the emails were there, all the marketing discussions, all the science discussions, all the data from all the trials were there, the whole thing. And my job, which I just loved, it was just such an interesting challenge, was to piece together how in each situation, the drug company would take that particular situation and create information, air quotes information, for doctors that would maximize the sales of the drugs. And I understand how it happens. I know how this happens, and I can tell you some of it, and a lot of it's written in Sickening, the book that I published in 2022. but I did that for about 10 or 12 years, and there was a lot of money changing hands. The plaintiffs were getting paid for their injuries, but the drug companies weren't changing their behavior because not enough of this information was getting out so that the public and especially doctors could understand that the drug companies aren't kidding around. Their job is to make money. And they'll do it as hard and bend the rules as far as they can until the cost of bending the rules is greater than the cost of playing by the rules. And that message wasn't getting out and still has not gotten out. Doctors don't have any idea how much they're playing would play, being played with, and the public can't possibly have any idea. And I hope we'll go into the details. But I decided that I would stop doing litigation and that I would write a second book and explain what I learned in my 12 years or so inside those corporate computers. Now, one of the things that I did during those years was I consulted with the FBI and the Department of Justice in the United States, because I would have information that was not public, that I couldn't say publicly, but occasionally I would call the Department of Justice and say, I know a lot about civil litigation with Vioxx or Baxter or other drugs, and if you subpoena me, then I will have to come and tell you what I know, and I'll have to bring my computer, and I'll have to share the hundreds of hours of research that I've put into this. And one of the examples of that was a drug called Bextra that I had worked on in civil litigation with 10,000 plaintiffs who were awarded a settlement, which is sealed, so nobody knows what the settlement was. But when I brought that information, when I was subpoenaed and brought that information to FBI headquarters in Boston and was questioned by the Department of Justice lawyers and FBI lawyers, the upshot of that was Pfizer was hit with the largest criminal fine in U.S. history, the largest fine ever in U.S. history, for its misrepresentation of the cardiovascular risk of Bextra, which was a drug like Vioxx, an arthritis drug that really offered no significant advantage and had the cardiovascular risk covered up. So when the data could be brought to the relevant authorities, they could act on it. But even a $1.2 billion fine of Pfizer, it doesn't erase their profits. It doesn't change their behavior. And virtually no drug executives went to jail. So they, as long as they were making money, they had an incentive to keep going. So I wrote Sickening. And before it was published, it was Great Guns. It was a bestseller on Amazon. And I was doing the biggest podcast, Rogan and Lex Fridman. And it was just looked like it was going to break through. The information was going to break through. And when it got published, literally a soundproof curtain dropped down around me. And I did virtually no TV. Tucker Carlson was the only person who would interview me. And I think he had his own motives. And no op-eds. I had many op-eds published in the New York Times and the LA Times, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where you are. But a soundproof barrier dropped down. And now it requires people like you, Catherine, to bring this story to the public so they can understand how much they're being cheated by the drug companies profiteering.
So Dr. John Abramson, thank you for your service to humanity. Can you explain for our audience? We're here today talking about statin drugs. And if you're listening to this broadcast and you're either taking statin drugs or you've been advised to taking statin drugs, you might want to listen to what Dr. Abramson has to say. So Dr. Abramson, can you explain for our audience, first of all, what are statin drugs? What are some of the common names they're sold under? What do they do?
So the names are easy. The names are like Lipitor and Crestor, Pravacol, Zocor. They're all kind of first cousins. They're similar biochemically. And what they do is most of the 80% of the cholesterol in our bodies is manufactured in our livers. It doesn't have to do with our diet. It's manufactured. And what the statin drugs do is they fool the biochemical pathway, the rate limiting step in the complex synthetic process of making statins in our liver. They fool the critical step in that series of chemical reactions into thinking that there's more of a statin-like drug. There's more cholesterol around than is needed, and it turns off the enzymes that manufacture cholesterol. So the statin drugs fool the liver into making less cholesterol.
And for our audience, can you explain what exactly is cholesterol? And we have to understand that if your body makes it, there's probably some good reasons your body's making cholesterol. So what is cholesterol, and why do we actually need cholesterol?
Right. And Catherine, I need to preface the answer to this important question by saying much of what we think we know about what cholesterol is, what it does, how it's harmful, how it can be lowered. Much of what we know because it's going to make money for the drug companies. And I'm ask the listeners now, this is a big ask, but I ask you to try and, when you hear this, put your mind frame in the, pretend you're a drug company executive who's a large chunk of your remuneration is going to come from how many drugs are sold. And within the culture, the C-suite culture of the drug companies or any other major corporation, the financial rewards for profitability are direct to the big executives. So their culture is thinking about how do we sell more statins. So when we talk about this, what we think we know is not what disinterested people have chosen to inform us because it's good for going to be good for our health. It's good for their profits. And so with that as a preface, ask your question again, please.
So what is cholesterol, and is cholesterol actually a bad thing for our health?
Well, cholesterol is a waxy-like substance that's surrounded by molecules that make it soluble in blood. So it's a fatty substance. About 25% of the cholesterol in the body is in the brain, and we certainly need that. And cholesterol is an integral component of many hormones in the body, which we couldn't synthesize without starting with a cholesterol building block. Now, the way we got to where we are now is the Framingham Heart Study, which was started in the, I think, the late 40s or early 50s, found that there was a correlation between cholesterol and the risk of heart disease. And that created what the drug companies call a target. So cholesterol seemed to be an enemy, and they could focus their research on lowering cholesterol. Now, we've got to remember, it's so important to remember, that having a certain level of cholesterol in your body is not necessarily harmful. The question is not, how do we lower our cholesterol? The question that we want to be asking, always catch yourself, the question we want to be asking is, how do we decrease our risk of heart attacks, blood clots, and strokes? It's not, how do we lower our cholesterol to get our cholesterol to the lowest point we can. So the Framingham Heart Study came along, and it suggested that there was a correlation between cholesterol levels and heart attacks. And the drug companies went to work developing drugs that would lower cholesterol. Now, the first generation of cholesterol-lowering drugs that came out in the late 70s, early 80s, were called fibrates, F-I-B-R-A-T-E-S. And they lowered cholesterol very well, but unfortunately, they increased the death rate. And that wasn't found out until they'd been out for a number of years.
I'm sorry if I'm laughing, right? Those were the first cholesterol drugs. The first cholesterol drugs actually increased the death rate. Whoops.
Correct. Correct. Okay. And that happened because our eye got taken off the ball because of the drug company's intellectual ether that they created. They made people and doctors believe that the goal was to lower cholesterol, and they forgot that the real goal is to make people healthier and live better lives. So after the fibrates had been out for a number of years, it was discovered that they increased death rates, and they were taken off the market. There was a gap for a little while, And then the first statin was developed in 1987. The name was Mevacor. And that lowered cholesterol, and its effect was unclear. The initial studies showed that there was some lowering of cardiovascular risk, but the extent to which the risk was lowered was not so great. And every drug and drug class is marketed uniquely to maximize drug sales. And with statins, what happened was the drug companies were doing studies to push their own specific drugs, but the effect size of these drugs was not high enough to make the drugs appear to be beneficial for large numbers of people. There wasn't enough statistical power in the studies that individual drug companies were running. So they figured out how to deal with that. And this is an elegant solution from a business point of view. It doesn't work so well from a public health point of view. What the drug companies did is they figured out that there was an organization at Oxford called the Cholesterol Treatment Trialists that was just forming up. And the purpose of that group was to receive data, all the clinical trial data from the companies that were funding studies on statins. They would receive all the data and they would put all the data together. So the statistical power would be five times more than the individual companies' studies were. But this was a Faustian bargain that we're still getting hurt from, which is the cholesterol treatment trialists received all the data, but they agreed to keep it secret. So now, when the cholesterol treatment trialists publish their meta-analyses, usually in The Lancet and usually every few years, as they recalculate the statistics and get some new data in. So the cholesterol treatment trialists do what's called meta-analyses, put all the data together, and they have the data, and then they publish these meta-analyses in The Lancet. Now, these meta-analyses are peer-reviewed, so you might think that the information that the doctors are reading in The Lancet and in their guidelines is good information because peer reviewers and expert guideline writers have reviewed this information. But here's the key. The peer reviewers and the experts who write the guidelines haven't seen the actual data. They're not allowed to see the data. The only data they can see is what the cholesterol treatment trialists choose to put in their 5 or 10-page articles that are published in Lancet, and
Dr.
not the.
John Abramson, let's take a break and listen to a message from one of our commercial sponsors here at UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Katherine Kerrigan, medical intuitive healer, Amazon number one best-selling author. We're listening to Dr. John Abramson, author of Sickening: How Big Pharma Broke America and Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. We'll be right back.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Dr. John Abramson, so you, because of your work as an expert witness, you've seen research that has not been available to the public or to other peer doctors who are writing articles. Can you explain for our audience, the general public who may be advised to take statin drugs, what are the actual side effects of statin drugs? What do we need to watch out for?
Well, the first answer is I can't explain what the side effects of statins are because the studies were paid for by the drug companies. And I think it's 40 out of 41 of the studies didn't prospectively inquire about the most common side effect, which is muscle pain, muscle cramping, muscle inflammation. So, as shocking as it is, the statins have been out since 1987, however many years, decades ago that is. And they're the most commonly prescribed drugs in the United States. I assume that's true for the UK as well. And we don't know what the incidence of side effects are. We don't know that. What doctors report, primary care doctors and cardiologists report, is that they think that about 20% of people who take statins develop muscle symptoms. Now, this is a problem because we'll get to this at the end of the show, but the real question that we're asking here is how do we lower the risk of heart attacks, blood clots, and strokes? And 80% of the ability to lower that risk has to do with how we live our lives, how we exercise, how we eat, whether we smoke, whether we're under stress, and so forth. So we don't know what the answer is, but what happens is when people consider, and we'll continue talking about this, but when people consider when their doctors say they should take a statin, they don't know what the side effects of the statin are. And they don't know that there are muscle symptoms that may prevent them from doing the things that will have a much greater effect of in lowering their risk of cardiovascular disease.
Now, in your book, Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It, you talk about, and I'm just generalizing from my reading of your book, you say that people who do not have heart disease, that if you take statin drugs, it maybe only extends your lifespan 1 or 2 days, correct?
Yeah, or actually the evidence may be not at all, or there's not evidence that it expands your life expectancy. But the key is here. The key is we've got to change our point of view, and we got to remember that the drug companies are trying to sell as much statin as they can, and our goal, and hopefully our doctor's goal, is to help us prevent cardiovascular disease as best we can. So these guidelines come out, and they tell your doctor whether your doctor should or should not recommend statins for you. And that is it's such a paternalistic and demeaning way to approach healthcare, because it's not like it's a switch, you should or should not take statins. The question is, what's your likelihood of benefiting from statins? That's what we should be talking about. And the guidelines should be training doctors how to have these conversations with people in plain English so that they can make an informed decision for themselves. So, for example, the best information we have, and it's based on non-transparent data, that data has never been released. So this is the drug company's view of the best that the statins will do for us. If you look at people who do not have heart disease, do not have a history of heart disease, and you have to treat between 100 and 140 people with statins in order to prevent one heart attack or stroke and not to significantly extend life. So, Catherine, if you were my patient, and you came to me and you said, "Doc, I know that heart disease is a significant risk for me, and I want you to tell me how to lower my cholesterol and how much benefit I'll get." And I say, "Well, I've done the calculations, and the guidelines say you should be on a statin." And you don't know where to go from that or how to process that information. The way that conversation ought to go is, Catherine, you're however old you are, a woman. And you don't
65.
Have heart disease. 65?
Yes.
You're doing well.
No drugs. Maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah.
No drugs, yeah. Anyway, but yoga.
yeah, good. Anyway, you said, I want to do everything I can to decrease my risk of heart disease. So, of course, I want to lower my cholesterol. And the guidelines say I should take a statin. And my response to you would be, as a 65-year-old woman without a history of heart disease and without a significant family history of heart disease at an early age, you'd have to treat between 100 and 140 people like you with a statin for 5 years in order to prevent one non-fatal heart attack, blood clot, or stroke. And we would not significantly lower your risk of dying. So that's the benefit. There is some benefit. There's not no benefit. There is some benefit. So how do you feel about that? Do you want to take a statin for 5 years in order to have a 1 out of 100 to 140 chance of deriving any benefit from taking that drug? And then that calls upon, we're now out of the scientific realm, and that calls upon your values. And I would hope that the next question that you would ask as a highly informed consumer is, well, that's not as impressive as I thought it was going to be. Are there other ways I can lower my risk of heart disease? And the answer to that is yes. You could lower your risk of heart disease by a few percentage points by taking statins, or you can lower your risk of heart disease by 80% by living a healthy lifestyle. And then I, as your physician, would say, let's change the conversation here and let's talk about where you can improve your lifestyle to minimize your risk of heart disease.
And with that, let's take a break and listen to a message from one of our commercial sponsors here at UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Kerrigan, medical intuitive healer, Amazon number one bestselling author. We're listening to Dr. John Abramson, author of Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So Dr. John Abramson, we talked about if someone does not currently have heart disease, that what the chances would be of improvement if they did take statin drugs. What about people who do have heart disease? For example, about a year ago, one of my best friends had open heart surgery. He's on a whole bunch of drugs. So what about people who do have a history of heart disease? Do the statin drugs help them?
Well, and it's a question of how much they'll help them. But the higher a person's risk of heart disease in the future, the more the statins will help them. So like I tried to change the conversation that you as a patient came in asking about how to lower your cholesterol to how do you prevent heart disease. The patient who already has heart disease is going to have a better chance of being healthy by statins, but it's still a decision about whether they should take a statin should be made by them based on their values, fully informed by the best knowledge we have. So patient who's had a heart attack comes into the office and says, doc, should I be on a statin? Or they'll probably be on a statin already, discharged on a statin. And the statistics show that you have to treat 30 people who have heart disease with a statin for 5 years to prevent one non-fatal heart attack or stroke. And you have to treat 80 people who have heart disease with a statin for 5 years to prevent one death. Now that's a lot better than the odds when you don't have heart disease, the odds of being helped. And when patients would come to me as a family doc, my patients would come to me and ask patients who had heart disease would ask if they should be on a statin. I would say, well, here's the facts as we know them. Only 1 out of 30 people will be helped with prevention of a heart attack or stroke or blood clot. And 1 out of 80 people won't die because they took a statin for 5 years. And I say to the patient, what do you think about those numbers? How do you feel? And typically, a patient would say, well, doc, I'm not really qualified to make that decision. What would you say? And what I would say is, well, 1 out of 30 and 1 out of 80 are finite numbers. I mean, it may help you. It's small. It's a small chance, but it might help you. And maybe you want to take a statin and we'll get back together again and make sure that there's no harm. You're not having muscle pain. You're not gaining weight because you think you have a free pass because you're taking statins. We'll follow you over time and make sure you're not having any harm from the statins. But if you want to take it, I'm not against it at all. In fact, if you ask me to decide for you, I would say go ahead and start the statin and let's get back together and make sure there's no harm being done.
No. Dr. John Abramson, I had a client in my office just the past week, and he's older gentleman, mid-70s, very healthy, exercises every day, no history of heart disease, on a statin drug, and his total cholesterol was below 150, right? So very, very low. And he told me, and many of our audience members may have heard this, had this gone through the same thing. He said his doctor kept changing the goalpost. So whereas before, you know, it was okay if his cholesterol was 200, now we want it lower and lower. And I, as I mentioned, no history of heart disease, no diabetes, very healthy person. Why do the statistical guidelines about cholesterol and statin drugs keep changing?
To sell more drugs. It's not complicated. The data from the CTT, now again, this is not transparent data. This is the drug company's version of the best that statins can do. And in the fine print in one of the meta-analyses published in The Lancet, the CTT data showed that a person like the person you just described, you have to treat 1,000 of those people for a year with a statin to prevent one non-fatal cardiovascular event. And they didn't present data about mortality, so I can assume it's not statistically significant. So I would say to that patient, if I were the doctor, the benefit that you will get from a statin, there's a 1 out of 1,000 chance each year you take the statin that you will avoid a heart attack or stroke or blood clot. And you make the decision. But I want to warn you, making the decision, don't think that you have to, don't give up the healthy lifestyle you have because you're taking a statin. Don't think that the statin is going to replace what you're doing for yourself, because what you're doing for yourself is far more important than taking a statin. And that's the message that I want to leave your listeners with. Take care of yourself. Don't let the propaganda and the profiteering of the drug companies mess with your head about what the real goal is here. And the goal is to live a lifestyle that's going to minimize your risk of cardiovascular disease. And most of us have trouble changing our habits, present company included on my side anyway. And that's where the medical intervention ought to be, to work with somebody who can help you get to the bottom of your inertia about not making positive steps.
So here at the Natural Healing Show for UK Health Radio, I've done many, many shows about how to heal your heart naturally. And so if you're listening and you want to learn about how to do that, please refer to my previous shows on this subject. Now, Dr. John Abramson, you mentioned that statin drugs are the most commonly prescribed drugs in the United States. So do you have any idea how much money are we talking about? How much money do the drug companies take by convincing us that we need these drugs, even though they don't statistically make that much of a difference?
Well, you ask a very interesting question, Catherine, because virtually all of the statins that are on the market now are available as generics. So the companies that originally marketed them continue to market them. And if you wanted to buy, say, brand name Lipitor made by Pfizer, you could. It would be more expensive than a generic. But most people would take the generic, and I would recommend that they do. And most pharmacists will fill the prescription with the generic because it's less expensive for the consumer. So it raises the question that now that the statins are off patent, that they've gone generic, why is there still such a push to get people onto statins? And what I'm going to say now, what I've said before, is I'm standing on it. It's the best knowledge available, and I can give you references for all of it. And the references are in my book. If you want to see that, if you look at the chapter on statins, you'll find a way to get all this information corroborated. but the the drugs are now on patent. So why are people still pushing it? And this is now my opinion, is that there are two reasons why. Number one is that those docs who committed to statins being so important, it's really tough to look at what you've done for thousands of patients over 30 years and say, gee, maybe that wasn't right. So still doctors are wanting to prescribe statins because they believed at one point that statins were the right thing to do and continue. It's hard to change doctors' mind. The other one is a little less obvious, that for people who can't tolerate statins or for people who don't get to their LDL targets, as you mentioned before, Catherine, there are now other kinds of drugs like PCSK9 inhibitors, biomedical drugs that are created by E. coli and genetic manipulation. Those drugs are very expensive. They lower cholesterol a lot, but they're very expensive. And the drug companies want to sell those drugs a lot. I mean, we're talking about thousands of dollars a year. But you can't, the drug company can't sell the PCSK9 inhibitor to anybody who hasn't been on a statin. So I, again, this is my opinion, but I think statins are really a gateway drug, the way they talk about marijuana being a gateway drug to harder drugs. I don't know whether it is or it isn't, but that concept, I think statins are now a gateway drug because you can't sell the really expensive drugs to people who haven't been on statins.
So let's take it back to the individual. So let's say I go to my doctor, I go for my annual physical, they draw my blood work and they say, gosh, you know, your cholesterol is outside our guidelines. What steps should an individual take if they go to their doctor and the doctor prescribes statin drugs?
Yeah. So I think the first step is to say to the doctor, what's the chance that this is going to help me? You want to prescribe a drug. What's the chance it's going to help me? Now, they may cite a figure like it'll reduce your risk of heart disease by 20%. But that's the relative risk. That means if you take a statin, you'll have 20% less chance of getting heart disease than somebody who doesn't take a statin. But you're not in competition with that person who's not taking a statin. You want to protect yourself from heart disease. So to do that, the 20% relative risk isn't relevant. The 1% absolute risk, the 1% that your chance of having a heart attack is going to go down is 1%. So you've got to look at the chance that it's going to help you. So your doctor says to you, Catherine, I'm looking at the guidelines here and saying to himself or herself, if I don't follow the guidelines and Catherine develops a heart attack, I'm going to get sued because I didn't follow the guidelines. And so there's a lot of pressure if the guidelines say you qualify for statin, for your doc to put you on a statin. What I say is that the conversation ought to not to be about yes, no, and it ought not to be whether the guidelines say you should or shouldn't be on a statin. The conversation ought to be about what's the chance that you're going to benefit from that statin. And you, as a healthy 65-year-old woman, are unlikely to have a mortality benefit at all. And you'll have a very slight reduction in your risk of having a heart attack, blood clot, or stroke. You know, maybe it's approximately 140 Catherine Kerrigans have to be treated for 5 years in order for one to benefit from to not have a non-fatal cardiovascular event. So I think the short answer to your question is you want to get the conversation down to what is the number needed to treat? How many people like me have to be treated with a drug like that over how many years in order to benefit? And if you are successful in getting the conversation in that direction, and I think doctors are starting to get the drift that they should have these conversations with their patients. If you're successful in getting the conversation there and you get to the real facts that you have to take a statin for 5 years in order to have one 140th chance of avoiding a heart attack, blood clot, or stroke, then you can talk to your doctor about how you feel about your odds of having the statin improve your health or protect your health.
So Dr. John Abramson, author of Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. Any final thoughts for our audience specifically about statin drugs?
Yes, I hope that audience, you're here because you want to take care of yourself, and you're probably here because you have a touch of skepticism about the straight medical world. And Catherine's providing great information, responsible, critical information. And what I want to say is don't forget that the drug company's job is to maximize their profits. That's their job. And it's to convince your doctors and you that taking their drugs, buying their drugs, is good for you when their real motive is that it's good for them. Now, that doesn't mean that all drugs aren't worth taking. I mean, I've had great medical care, and I probably wouldn't be alive without my great medical care. And that's what makes all this so difficult. And it becomes so important to learn how to talk to your doctor about the real stuff, not just, I think the drug companies are crooks and I'm not taking that crap, but what do we really know about what's the chance this drug is going to help me? And then let's have that discussion, not what the guidelines are.
You've been listening to the Natural Healing Show for UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Kerrigan, medical intuitive healer, Amazon number one bestselling author. You can find out more about Dr. John Abramson and his wonderful work by reading his books, Overdosed America and Sickening. And remember, natural healing actually works. And if you want to lower your risk of heart attack, blood clots, and strokes, you're more likely to get statistically significant benefits by improving your lifestyle, according to Dr. John Abramson. So,
absolutely.
Yes. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Natural Healing Show. Keep it natural with the Natural Healing Show.